6, Stepstone Group.
So I just want to introduce this for the trustees and kind of frame up what we're going to be going over here. You'll recall back in April, the board voted to retain Stepstone Group both for private equity, non-discretionary advisory services, and for private credit discretionary advisory services. We have completed the contracting on the private equity side. Jose Fernandez is here to talk about pacing, and this is kind of a forward-looking estimation of how much capital Cicero will be deploying in order to get to and maintain private equity target over the next couple of years. Some of our longer-standing trustees will recall we did this back in 2013, where we talked about capital deployment, forward-looking levels, and what our expectations were in terms of where we would focus our attention. So this is an update of that exercise with our new partner. You recall Cicero has a 10% target for private equity, and we're relatively close to that. I think that's reviewed on an annual basis, but Stepstone is here to talk about where they intend to deploy capital and what the game plan is. And this is advisory only. There's no board action here. This is just a forward-looking assessment.
Jose? Great. Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here as officially as your advisor. So good to be back. I think you all have the presentation, so if you want to go to page 5, just a reminder on who the team that is dedicated to Cicero at Stepstone. You have myself, also Tom Keck, Natalie Walker, and Key Liu. Natalie, just to give you the news ahead of time, Natalie will be going on maternity leave any day now, but expected towards the end of October. While she's out, Key Liu will be working with me and Tom to work on Cicero. So we will miss her, but you will be served and will not notice her absence, although I will. And Jason Mann is our legal counsel, who, as we make investments, he'll be involved in some of the negotiations. If you turn to page 6, this just sets the framework. What we're trying to do for Cicero is to build a global private equity portfolio that produces capital appreciation for your investment. The target asset allocation for the total portfolios, including private equity and real assets, is 12% of the total fund fair market value. As Tim mentioned, you're close to 10% now, and we'll get into some details on these. And the ranges that we have set out for these asset classes, and we'll talk about why we've decided on these ranges later on, but for buyout is 60 to 70%. So we're not looking for a very exact number. These are ranges because, as you know, in private equity, you commit capital, then you invest it over a 5-year period, and as you're investing, you're also receiving distributions from these funds. So it's very hard to get to a very precise number, and that's why we use ranges. So buyout is this range of 60 to 70%. Special situations, 5 to 15%. Venture capital and growth equity, also 5 to 15%. And the same for real assets and natural resources. And then secondaries, which you have some exposure now, but we would have a range between 0 and 10%. Our geographic preference is going to continue to be North America. Currently, the overwhelming majority of your private equity investments are in North America. And we'll talk about geographic exposures and why we think having some exposure outside of North America makes sense, but it's just be a very gradual exposure outside of North America. Our time horizon, we're looking at 5 to 10 years to get to this target, and implementing it by investing in primary partnerships. So we're going to find managers and invest in their funds. On page 7, it's got the portfolio by strategy. When you look at the graph, on the left-hand side is the private equity index. What that means is this is the fundraising activity by private markets funds over the last 10 years. So this is not a suggested allocation or what the ideal allocation is. This is just what the market has been. This is the capital that has been raised by private equity fund managers over the past 10 years in those strategies. In the middle is Cicera's actual exposure as of June 30, 2017 to the different subsectors. And on the right-hand side is our recommended long-term target. The percentages that are there is the midpoint of the ranges that I just went over on the page before. So why are we recommending these exposures? You can see that the material changes here are your real assets exposure today is 30%, while the market over the last 10 years is represented only 16%. So we think that over time, reducing that exposure makes sense. Number one, because it will be closer to what the market reflects in terms of opportunities. Also, number two, because we believe the opportunities to make private equity returns north of 12% net in real assets are much more limited. So you start with a more limited number of managers, and then from those managers, the ones that can produce a 12% net is even more reduced. So that's why we think that new investments should be limited in the next few years, and that will bring down your exposure over time to a range of 5 to 15%, which we think is more prudent. Also increasing the allocation that today you have exposure to 2% to special situations. We think going to a range of 5 to 15% is more prudent given the market today. I'll talk more about the market later. But special situations means managers that are looking at distressed opportunities primarily. So when companies are in trouble, either because of operations or because of capital structure, generally if they are in bankruptcy and looking to do a turnaround, that's what special situation managers do. Obviously, we've been in a benign economic environment the past few years, and there's not been a lot of distress in the market. So actually, the fact that you have little exposure to that now has been good because there's not a lot of opportunities for those managers to exploit. But as this market has gone on now, and is becoming the longest economic recovery that we've seen, and we know at some point it's going to turn, and these managers are going to be well positioned to make outsized returns when the market turns. So having more exposure to them over the next 5 years, we think is going to put you in a good position. And finally, on the buyout side, where you're already at 53%, and we think that the range should be 60 to 70%. The reason for that is that's where the most opportunities are, but also we think where the strongest managers are. It's the most developed in terms of time that managers have been in the pursuing their strategies, and therefore where the better opportunities are. So that's why we think your portfolio should be heavily weighted towards the buyout space. And if you turn to the next page to put a finer point on it, here you have the median return, the pooled returns. So these are the returns over the last 10 years. Actually, it's a 20-year period from 1995 to 2014. What the pooled returns have been for each of these asset classes. And the black dot in the middle of each of the columns is the loss ratio associated with that strategy. And we've calculated this loss ratio using our database of actual transactions by in each of these subsectors. But we haven't taken the fund level fund ratio, but actually gone and looked at specific transactions in our database and look at what the loss ratio is. This gives you a perspective of what the risk-adjusted return is, right? So you can see that the best performing sub-asset class has been venture capital at 12.7%, but they have by far the largest loss ratio, which means that you're taking on more risk to generate that better return. And that's the reason why we're not recommending that you do 60% in venture capital, because you have to take on a higher amount of risk in order to generate that return. In the buyout space, you can see that it's still a 20% loss ratio for an 11.3% return, but that's still providing a good risk-adjusted return. And I will point out that the when we talk about the pacing and see the number of investments we recommend you make per year, which is going to start at about two in the first couple years, going to four, to six or eight investments. This is, you're going to get to choose over the next 12 months two, maybe three investments out of more than 3,000 investment opportunities. That puts you in a great position to find the best risk-adjusted returns. So, you know, this is what the market has done. Of course, we're going to be looking for better than the market. So, of course, we're going to be looking for. Yeah,
Jay, it'd be helpful to me. Internal rate of return is a reasonably understandable number. Then we've got loss ratio. I'm not sure I know what you mean by that.
Yeah.
Could you give us an example?
Absolutely. Loss ratio is the amount of capital that a manager loses out of the invested capital. So this means is that bio managers invest $100, they lost $20. That's the loss ratio. Now that means they still have a positive return, because what it means is a manager goes out and buys 10 companies. And let's just say those 10 companies, they had $100, they put $10 in each one of those companies. So what this is telling you is that if they lost 20%, it's $20 out of the 100 they invested. So two companies, they lost all their capital. But the other eight, they made money on, and that's how so they make up for the losses, and they generate a positive return.
But okay, so the 20, I mean, it could be five of them drop
20% each.
A net number that produces 20 of the 100.
Exactly.
All right.
So it could be a total loss in one company, or it can be a partial loss.
Basically, they're under the line. In other words, the break-even line.
This is under the break-even line.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
But they make it up with other gains.
Good.
Since Cesar is looking at increasing their exposure to the special situations category, could you comment for the board briefly on what would be included in that category?
What these groups specialize in is buying companies that are in distress. And I mentioned it can be operational distress or financial distress. Operational distress, it could be a company that's growing very rapidly and doesn't have the capacity to produce the goods that they're producing fast enough for the market. That's actually becomes a real problem for the company, because if they don't deliver on time, they're going to lose future business. And there are companies that specialize in coming in and helping these companies work out the problems they have in their production to be able to produce in time. That's one aspect of that. The more common aspect is financial distress. So it's companies that are on the brink of bankruptcy or in a bankruptcy process. And these companies come in and recapitalize those distressed companies. So they provide fresh capital in order for these companies to be able to continue to operate and to turn around what's been typically a money-losing business into a profitable business.
So this is very akin to what we've done in a lot of the real estate through the crisis, what we did with Oaktree and with Angelo Gordon and Paulson, where there was financial stress in these assets, came in there, recapitalized them. We're taking that out of the real estate realm and bringing it more directly into the private equity realm. So the examples in our current lineup would be Oaktree's private investment fund 2009, which was a collection of three underlying funds for distress for control. Financial distress, they could take control of the company, restructure it, make it profitable, sell it. So we have something like that we have in the portfolio. We certainly have done pieces of this. It's going to be a bigger piece going forward.
To follow on John's earlier question, does the loss ratio in the aggregate pose a danger? I mean, I read that and say, okay, a third of VC money doesn't make it, right? It's like drilling for oil, right? You get some productive wells, the other ones you capped and walked away from. So you get about a 1.4% swing between, or difference between, the buyout return, right, and the venture capital return, but you have a 13% difference in the loss ratio. But what I'm trying to get at is, does it matter in the aggregate? Because you're not investing in the specific companies, and you're not going to be in the third that went off, right?
You're exactly right. That's why I highlighted that you're going to make two investments out of 3,000 managers that are raising capital in the next 12 months. So this is what the market has done. Obviously, we're not, you know, you're never going to reproduce these returns with your investments, right? It's going to be better or worse. But obviously, we at Cicera is in a position to pick the very best managers. And that, you know, those managers have produced historical returns that are better than 11.3% in the buyout space with lower loss ratio than 20%. And that's what we're looking for. What we're going to present to Cicera for investments are groups that have historically produced better returns than what are in this graph with lower loss ratios than what are in this graph. Okay. This is just a picture of what the market is. This is what the 3,000 managers have done in the aggregate. But you're absolutely right.
But it's really telling. It's very helpful.
Yeah. You know, I mean, venture capital, we've always talked about, you know, you're going to have a lot of losses and one or two really big winners that return the fund if everything works out according to plan. And this is just a way of illustrating, you know, that risk factor is high. It's a higher returning asset class, but you have a lot more misses embedded in there.
For every Tesla, there's 100 of the people you never heard of. Right?
There you go. Yeah. And that's why, you know, we're going to be biased towards buyout special situations, safer return streams. Yeah. Not without risk.
Yeah. No, less. Nothing. Yeah, nothing risk-free.
So if you switch to page 9, unless you have any other questions. So on page 9 is the recommended exposure by geography. And here we added one extra column for GDP activity, so gross domestic product of North America, Europe, and the rest of the world. Rest of the world mainly driven by Asia, as it implies here. And we just want to show you, you know, here's the private equity index, which is the same as I mentioned before, over the past 10 years, how much capital was raised in these different geographies. And you can see that 60% basically was raised in the U.S., so the, you know, North America, which is still the dominant market. I will note that on Cicera's column, we say 100% U.S. The fact is you do have some exposure outside the U.S. We have done this analysis just based on your fund investments and where those fund managers are based, but not where the companies that they have invested in are based. Next time we report to you, we will have all the data to be able to show you at an actual company investment level that you do have some investments outside of North America. But the fact is it's going to be a small percentage. So our long-term target, and this long-term meaning that over the next 5 to 10 years where we think you should be, is for North America in a range of 70 to 90%, and for the other two areas, Europe and Asia, rest of the world, 5 to 15%. The midpoint is what's reflected in the column here. You know, we obviously think when you look at the fact that the economic activity, almost half of it, is taking place in Asia and rest of the world, you really need to have some exposure to that. And that's the fastest growing part of world economic activity. So you just can't ignore it. And Europe is still a quarter of the world's economic activity. So having some exposure there, you can't ignore it. But the fact is, you're a North America-based pension fund with assets and liabilities in dollars. So we think it is prudent to have the vast majority of your assets still in North America.
Right, but what that translates to is that what you're really saying is we want to be in the European buyout space, right?
You're gonna, yes.
That's where you want to put the chips. Yeah,
absolutely, what we would be looking at is European buyout space, and in Asia, when we talk rest of the world, it's mainly Asia, it's not really a buyout economy, it's more of a growth equity economy. So those are growth companies. They're, you know, the traditional buyout where you buy 100% of a company and put some leverage on it, that's not really, there is some of that going on in Asia, but the real activity in Asia in private equity is growth equity, where you find a company that's growing very fast and you can invest somewhere to take, you could take control of it, but most of it is actually a minority position, but significant minority position, 40%, 48%. And you are partnering with the founders of those companies to continue to grow.
Are there any carve-outs in something like Asia? Like, is it ex-Japan, or would it be any opportunity in Asia that would be attractive?
We look at all of Asia. I mean, we think Japan was an area that was not attractive over the past few years. It's become much more attractive lately. There's
past
much few more.
Years. Seems to me that the lost decade became the lost two decades.
Yes. And so they haven't had they haven't participated in the growth.
Right.
But Japan, part of the solution that they see is private company. Japan is controlled by a lot of large corporate conglomerates. And those are starting to see that there's efficiencies in selling some of their businesses to private equity. So there's been a lot more transactions in the last 3 years that we didn't see before.
So you wouldn't exclude Japan?
We would not exclude Japan. We
if
wouldn't exclude any region.
Yeah.
I would say we are very careful with all investments in Asia with respect to, obviously we know issues about political corruption, about reporting.
But at least not China.
The reporting of financial information, all of this we take great care to make sure that the managers that we're investing with don't have any of those issues. And when you look at this, what this means in a practical, we'll talk about the number of investments again, but what it means in a practical manner is over the next 5 years we may do 2 investments in Asia, rest of the world, two managers. So it's going to be a limited number. Yeah. We're going to be very deliberate in how we do it.
And I think, importantly on this page is we're going to be looking for StepStone's breadth to help us here, where we have had a U.S. focus, the team's had a U.S. focus by issue of resources, candidly. StepStone's breadth is going to allow us to get some insights into Europe, Asia, Latin America, including culture, corporate governance, operational due diligence. So now we have additional resources. This becomes a viable place to look, and we'll see if we find something.
And having a team there is really important. And we do, we have teams in China, Japan, Australia, which in order to do the due diligence, you really need to have local people speak the language, are in the networks there, and know who the right people to do business are.
And this, by design, I assume, totally removes any South American, any Latin American.
It's part of what we call rest of world.
Rest
if
of world.
We did anything, and we mentioned here on the towards the bottom of the text here, we recommend an opportunistic approach with the majority of any outside U.S. exposure coming through either global funds, so funds that are investing on a global basis, or what we call pan-regional funds. So it wouldn't be a Japan-focused fund, but an Asia-focused fund that might invest in Japan and China. And if we did anything in Latin America, it would be a regional fund that invests across the region. So they're not forced to, if you're only doing 1 or 2 investments, it's hard for you to diversify the risk. Some of our clients can build a diversified portfolio of a Brazil manager and a Mexico manager. Because of the number of investments we're going to recommend here, if we have any exposure in Latin America, it's going to be one manager that shouldn't be limited to just Brazil or just Mexico, because then you're not diversified enough, but it should be a regional fund. So they're not forced to put capital to work in a country when it's not the best time to do it.
Actually, just a quick question there. So I think it makes complete sense for the investment staff to have StepStone here as a partner, gives you access to much more resource base. I wonder if the StepStone folks had taken the opportunity to review the existing private equity investments. And aside from the pacing plan, were there any immediate gaps you might need to fill, whether it's geography, vintage year, whatever? Are there any kind of more urgent recommendations other than, say, the 2 to whatever investments
right.
you might make on them?
Yeah, we have looked at what your portfolio is, and you have a portfolio of close to $900 million of net asset value, so it's an insignificant portfolio, mm-hmm. and it has performed well. We went through this during the RFP process and part of our presentation to you, which is your portfolio has been heavily concentrated in fund of funds. And what those fund of funds do is they provide you very diversified exposure to the private market. That's very helpful in terms of controlling risk, but it also can limit your upside because you essentially construct an index, and then it starts looking more like the page before the whole market because you had a number of different fund of funds. They're all investing in a lot of other funds, so your portfolio becomes over-diversified, and we think over-diversification is just as harmful as under-diversification in terms of risk. You end up with an index portfolio. And what we had recommended was that you should move towards a more targeted approach where you're going to focus on more specialist funds than generalist funds. So, for example, a manager that is only focused on healthcare, or a manager that's only focused on industrial companies, or a manager that's only focused on consumer sector. Those managers, we believe, produce better returns. Well, the data shows they produce better returns than the generalist. And the reason we believe that is because they are much more knowledgeable about the sector they're in. That's the only sector they're in every day, so they're not going from one sector to another. They have much better networks to find companies, to do diligence on companies, and really important, to find management teams for those companies. So for those reasons, we really like the specialist managers over generalist managers. But there is no urgent change that needs to be made. We think these changes are made over time, over the next 5 to 10 years, as your existing portfolio winds down, and that you know, roughly $900 million of net asset value, because it is in a fund of funds. Mostly fund of fund structure, it will start returning capital to you back very quickly over the next few years. So that net asset value will go down fairly quickly. So there's really nothing that you need to proactively do to change the portfolio other than wait for it to give you distributions back. But we do think that reorienting the portfolio from the fund of funds to managers directly, and those managers being specialists, that's the way we like to orient the portfolio.
That's great.
The only thing I would add would be we are going to be very measured about our approach to the market. It's a couple of deals per year. You know, one of my concerns is we not have manager proliferation within the private equity. We have a collection of very high quality managers that give us diversification, but I certainly don't want to be back in front of this board in 5 years and showing you the last, you know, 75 funds that we've invested in. That does nobody any favors here. So I'd say the only emphasis we would have in that measured approach would probably be on special situations over other things, simply because it's a smaller portion of the current portfolio. That said, we're not going to put money into special situations to get an allocation up. We're looking for the right partner. If that happens in the next 6 months, great. If that happens in the next 18 to 24 months, so be it.
Okay.
So page 10 goes over the investment process. We, back in April, we went over this, but just as a reminder of what we expect in terms of interaction with the board and the staff, the program guidelines set and approved with the staff and then the board. That's really what we're doing today, right? Setting the guidelines and the guideposts that we will abide with as we go forward with implementing the plan. After that, it's really a lot of work with staff, which we have been doing already, in terms of putting together a pipeline of opportunities. So staff has now available through our database, you can see all the opportunities that we see. But like I mentioned, there's 3,000 in the market. So we narrowed that down to a pipeline of what we think are more actionable opportunities, what are the best funds available in the market over the next 12 months. And with that full list, and we still over 75 funds on that list, and we're gonna winnow that down through monthly calls and more frequent as necessary, and doing introductions for the staff to the particular managers that we find more attractive, that they agree. So that they can start building a relationship directly as well with those managers. And from there, then we are going to pick, you know, the 2 to 4 investments in a year that are going to be made, so a full due diligence exercise by your staff and by us, and we coordinate, make sure that they get all our materials that they need to do their work in a timely manner. And to the extent that a presentation to the board is necessary, I know we have pending the authority to the staff to make investments up to $100 million. While that's pending, we may come to the board for an approval. And if we were ever to recommend more than $100 million, of course, we come to the board for approval. And then we'll be providing quarterly and annual reports. Those are written reports that we'll provide on your existing portfolio and anything new that's done after we start implementing the program. And as needed, we'll come to the board and present those quarterly and annual progress reports so you can see what the performance has been and how the portfolio is doing.
How do those correlate with Veris's quarterly reports?
It's a great question. We're having an integration call tomorrow to nail down the data sharing. And a lot of it's going to be based upon timing of getting things into the Veris report there. We want to have continuity of data collection, so we're going to be working with Veris, Stepstone Group, and you know, making sure that the data collection of managers goes out once. It might go to two parties, then, or three parties, including Cicera. But we're going to be hammering that out over the next week or so.
So if you go to page 12, this is the pacing analysis. And what we're doing with the pacing analysis is an exercise to project how much capital Cicera should invest on an annual basis in order to achieve and maintain its target allocation to the private equity program of 12%. So as of the fiscal year end, June 30th, you were at 10.5% exposure. So what our model suggests that the allocation should be is that over the next 2 years, $100 million per year. That goes up to $200 million per year the following 2 years, and then it goes up to $300 million for a few years, and then up to $400 million. What I will stress is this is a model, and this is based on cash flow projections of what we expect the portfolio to do based on historical cash flows that we have in our database. This is also, the model also takes into consideration what the rest of the portfolio at Cicera does. So this is only 12% of your portfolio. What the other 88% of your portfolio does, obviously, is very relevant to what happens to these projections. For that reason, we do these projections every year. So we'll come back next year and make sure that we're still on target, right? We can tell you from experience, this model works very well. Even in times of stress, like the great financial crisis, the model actually was very predictive of how the deployment should take place. But still, we'll review it every year. We'll come back to you and show this to you every year. But we feel pretty comfortable that if you do $100 million next year and the following year, that will get us to the 12% target. And from there, because I mentioned that you have a portfolio that's heavily weighted to fund of funds, and the fund of funds cash flows tend to be coming waves. So as they mature, your cash coming back is going to increase pretty materially. And that's the reason why we need to increase the amount of capital deployment in as the years go on, because you're going to be getting a lot of this $800 million of net asset value back in the next 5 years, and you need to replace that with new commitments.
You partially answered a question I was going to ask about the rate of return, because the model, at least, is a 10-year model with an assumption of 7%, which you said you're going to change. So to the extent that there's a possibility that that assumption might change, or the performance might change, because this is kind of the discount rate, is it likely that we'll be asked to try and make up the difference in this part of the portfolio? In other words, if the rest of the portfolio performs at 6.8,
right,
and we still want to assume, so are we likely to look at this as our adjustable
portion? This is probably not going to be your adjustable portion. The liquid markets are going to be the adjustable portion. I mean, we need to be cognizant that we're going to commit the capital that's going to be deployed for a decade, roughly. So this is the slower-moving battleship here. and we want to make sure that the pacing plan is prudent, but not, we don't want to get this overly precise, simply because the other 88% of the portfolio is going to be in motion. So this has got to be, think of this as 12% of the portfolio kind of on a smoothed value basis. We need to have a game plan in place. We'll do course corrections if everything works out great and the portfolio returns 20% a year for 5 years, suddenly there's a lot more capital, and to get to a 12% allocation, we're going to need to make some changes here. Also, if there's a recession, which is probably more likely than 5 years of 20% returns, we might need to tap the brakes here. So think of this as, this is our game plan. We might have to tap the gas or tap the brakes, but not make wholesale changes from this.
Thanks. And so our recommendation is $100 million the next couple of years. That increases to $400 million over a 10-year period. But we strongly recommend a limited number of managers in with that capital. So two managers when you're doing $100 million a year, four managers when you're doing $400 million a year. And the reason is what Tim mentioned about not having proliferation of managers. We think very often pension funds start investing in private equity because there's 3,000 investment opportunities, and a lot of them are really good. It's hard to maintain the discipline and say, I'm only going to do two or four. There's 10 fantastic ones. And then you end up with a portfolio of 100 funds, and that is the over-diversified portfolio that's going to produce either index or worse returns, and takes a lot of manpower to manage. So just there's a lot of negatives related to that. So maintaining the discipline of keeping the manager count low is a very strong recommendation of ours. Okay, so if you go to page 14, just to give you a flavor for the market and how StepStone looks at the market. So here you have the different sectors on the top, and then the sub-sectors in terms of whether global for us means the funds that are raising more than $10 billion, and then large are funds raising up to $10 billion, and the small and mid-market is obviously the funds raising mid-market. We go up to $6 billion. So $6 billion and below is our small market. Small market is for us is $1 billion and below. So 1 to 6 is mid-market. 6 to 10 is large market, and over 10 is global market. And this gives you a little bit of a heat map of what we think is more interesting today. The green is what we find the most interesting in terms of a short-term investment opportunity. So you can see that means we talked about special situations in North America. We think that's very interesting. In Europe, somewhat less interesting than in North America, but still interesting for special situations. And the same on the buyout side. We think buyouts in North America, small, mid, and large, are very interesting now. A lot of opportunities in those markets. The rest are lower priority, but doesn't mean we wouldn't do them, right? If we find the right manager in one of these other areas, we may come and recommend that to you. Now, the concerns we have, right? Everyone talks, I'm sure you hear this all the time. Valuations are very high, both in the public markets and the private markets, and we won't argue that is true. However, as we look at the environment, we think that a recession will come. We don't believe it's coming soon. The reasons we don't believe that. We think the market, while it looks like valuations are very high, when you look at certain segments that are driving those valuations, some of them might be justified. So the highest valuations are in the tech sector. You see double-digit purchase multiples. That's the price that they pay for a company. So if you take what their earnings are and what the how many times you multiply that four times gives you the purchase multiple. These purchase multiples in the tech sector are very, very high. But these are also companies that have tremendous cash flow generation, and they don't have a lot of capital expenses. They're software companies, so they're not investing in plants and equipment. So all of the cash flow generation, a lot of it translates into profit because they're not reinvesting the cash flow. So we think some of those high valuations could be justified for those companies. But we also think, given the low interest rate environment, it's been a benign environment on the interest rates, which allows these companies also to support the debt that they have better. And while they have more debt, so the other thing you hear about high purchase price multiple, I explained that we think some of that could be justified because the companies are producing the earnings. And then you hear about very high debt multiples, high debt loads. But again, this is very different than right before the great financial crisis, when companies only had equity cushions, or the amount of equity that they had of the total capitalization of the company being in that time 20%. Today it's closer to 50%, and it still is. So it's true they have higher debt multiples, but it's a stronger capital structure, because if there's a downturn, there's more equity behind these companies than there used to be right before the Great Recession. And one last fact that I'll give you, during the last cycle in the 90s, first 38 quarters of that cycle before it turned, the economic growth was 37%. The economy grew 37%. It's a very healthy growth over 37 quarters. Well, the current recovery, we're more than 38 quarters into it, and economic growth is only 12%. So compare 12% to 37%. It's just less heated, in our opinion. It's been more disciplined. So, you know, while there are signs that, you know, there's trouble ahead, and all these, the cycles never go up forever, so it will turn. But we do think that there's some fundamentals there that can allow it to run for at least a couple more years. So in summary, on page 15, in terms of what are priorities for the next fiscal year, what we're looking to do is to deploy somewhere between $25 to $50 million per fund in no more than four relationships. But since we have a $100 million allocation for the year, our expectation as we look at it is two to three relationships in a 12-month period, where we're going to focus on U.S. small and medium buyout space, U.S. large buyout space, and North America distress and restructuring, that's special situations. and our recommendation is, you know, if you do two to three relationships, that you do $50 million per relationship. So that's our focus. That's what we've already been working with staff on, in terms of having the wide, big list of opportunities, narrowing that down to a more manageable list of opportunities, and then now the process is, how do we get that to just a handful of opportunities where we can select two or three in a 12-month period?
Is it your intention to stay in that 50 million kind of an area per?
I think as we go more to the $300 to $400 million per year deployment, then that would step up.
That's kind of what that, yeah. As that goes up, the size.
If that goes up, we would expect commitment to go to $100 million per relationship.
That makes sense.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.